Welcome, everybody, to this week's edition of Everything Fast Pitch by Fast Pitch Prep. Today, we're going to be releasing some segments from previously recorded episodes. As we've got Tori laid up in the hospital, he's on the injured reserve list, and we're going to give him a little bit of time to recoup and feel better again before we get back into new content. We'll look forward to getting Tori back in the studio to record here very soon, but until then, we're going to be releasing some of the previously recorded episodes that, you know, had been highly rated and most listened to. So we hope you enjoy these.
In our leadoff topic, we're going to talk about coaches who yell, some things about that and some points that we want to raise. On our cleanup topic, we're going to talk about a phenomenon that just seems to be more and more evident to me on a daily basis, is that I think we just have too many travel teams. And I think that there's explanations for why and problems that that's causing. And then our coaching tip of the week, we're going to talk about one of the oldest axioms that we've ever heard about: look good, play good. So Don, before we get into any of the topics, let's talk about our sponsors. First, the Anderson Bat Company. Everything Fast Pitch is very proud to have Anderson Bat Company as our presenting sponsor. Anderson Bat Company is using the latest and greatest bat technology to corner the market in the fast pitch world. They have the -9 rocket tech, the -10 carbon, and the -11 carbon light. We're also working with Anderson to provide a discount for all of our listeners. Go to the Anderson Bat Company website and order your bats. Use the EFP20 discount, which is for Everything Fast Pitch, and you'll get a 20% discount. So Don, had a last-minute adjustment to the schedule today. I want us to talk about coaches who yell. So full disclosure, full disclaimer, for the vast majority of my career, I was a screamer and a yeller. I grew up in a world in a time when all the coaches I played for were screamers and yellers.
Right.
Many of them had a military background, and back then in the military, it was a screaming and yelling.
I think all our parents had that background.
Intimidating,
right?
World. During my playing career coming up, I was called every name you can imagine. I was insulted.
But that was motivation then.
And we were used to it. We took it. And we didn't complain about it at home, because if we went home and complained to our parents would scream and yell at us for complaining about the person who was screaming and yelling at us at practice.
Right.
Here's the question I want us to raise and talk about a little bit. So the old, I wish I knew then what I know now thing that we talk about over and over and over again. I think I spent an awful lot of time and regretfully spent an awful lot of time in my life coaching the way I was coached, and thinking that, you know, kind of confusing some of the things about softball, about the game of fast pitch, and some of the other sports, some of the other coaching styles. So one of the things that I think has happened is that screamers and yellers are usually trying to use that as a arousal technique,
a way to get
you pumped up, to get you fired up, to get your blood boiling a little bit. And unfortunately, I think where there's some sports that your blood boiling might be a real strength, I'm not so sure fast pitch softball is one of those.
No, I think we need a little calmer environment to do some of the skills that we need in our game. But I think that we replicate what we experienced as kids too. In our defense, that doesn't mean it's right, for sure. And me personally, I think I save the yelling for that critical moment when somebody's about to get hit or hurt or something. But definitely grew up with it.
Yeah,
that's just part of the game to me as well. I know a lot of personalities react different too, and the kids are different now.
Right.
I think we're in different times, so we've got to grow with that and see if we can save our yelling for certain instances,
right?
Maybe. Yeah.
Well, and I think one of the challenges that we're always trying to address with the podcast is helping the coaches and players and parents that are listening to us not make some of the same mistakes that we made. Kind of become more complete, more well-rounded, kind of have a perspective on things that's a little bit more complete maybe than it might be. And a lot of the people that are listening to us are that next generation younger than us. So they're,
I was going to say, we're almost two generations out now.
Yeah.
Huh?
So we're talking to parents and coaches that are definitely from a different time than we were. Somewhere along the spectrum, I think, is the right amount of all things for all coaches. And I think even for the most moderate, even-keeled, calm coach on the planet, that every once in a while there is some benefit in raising your voice and being a little bit louder and being a little bit more aggressive, But I think that where it's different now is it needs to be, you know, something that is strategically thought of and strategically used. It can't be the right. It can't be the default. I can't, you know, every time we make a mistake, I can't go back to just screaming and yelling at the person who made a mistake. Because the moral to the story is no player ever comes to the ballpark thinking, wow, I really hope I can make six errors today.
Right.
I really hope I can swing really terribly and miss the ball by 15 feet. I really hope I can drop that pop-up when the bases are loaded in the seventh inning and it costs us the game. I mean, none of these kids are starting their day off thinking that that's what they're trying to accomplish.
Let's see how loud I can make Coach yell at me, right? No, I think maybe for me too, Tori, is I took it pretty personal. If somebody, you know, yelled at me or was that discontent with my performance in any way as an athlete, that, you know, I took it personal. So maybe that's why I don't yell quite as much. But it can be a little impactful or traumatizing for a kid, right?
Right. And so the first thing I want us to think about is for parents and coaches both is when a player makes a mistake, before we, you know, decide to fly off the handle, let's kind of take a look at what the situation is, that what's contributing, what might have been, you know, part of the responsibility. And perfect example, team that I work with played a little scrimmage a couple weeks ago. At the beginning, we didn't really have enough time to warm up. You know, something had gotten messed up with the schedule. A couple of kids had gotten stuck in traffic. It was just one of those, you know, nothing about the way things worked as we were getting ready to play went like business as usual. Just like everything was totally out of whack. Had kids that, you know, were out there playing defense that didn't even like get a single ground ball hit to them in warmups. And all of a sudden, you know, the ball's getting scorched at them in the scrimmage. And they're not making all the plays.
Right.
And, you know, and of course, because we're not making plays, you know, everybody gets frustrated. Everybody gets angry. Parents start yelling. Coaches start yelling. Everybody starts, you know, getting all like, you know, beside themselves. And in my mind, I kept thinking, well, I wish we were playing better, but
what did we do?
What could I expect? How can I expect a, you know, 13-year-old shortstop to be ready for the ball to get scorched at her five hitters in a row when she hasn't seen a ground ball today? Before that first ball got scorched at her.
Right.
How can I expect my hitter who, you know, was stuck in traffic and didn't take one swing prior to, you know, jumping in the dugout when the game was started and was, you know, taking some warm-up swings on the side, dry swings on her own, was the only quote-unquote batting practice she had that day, was totally, you know, unrelated to what she was going to have to do walking up to the plate and not getting a hit. And being mad or frustrated or wanting to yell about that stuff just seemed kind of foolish. So from that coaching and parent perspective, if your daughter's making an error, before you get mad and yell at her to get her head out of her whatever, or get frustrated or get, you know, want to yell something, think about, well, okay, but did we do a good enough job? Is she really prepared to be able to do this? Second part of it is before we make up our mind to, you know, to be mad or to yell about something, whether it's from a coaching or a parent perspective, is did we really work on these things enough in practice to expect to be able to do them well? So first scenario is we didn't warm up well enough, so the kids weren't ready to play in the short term. Long term, have we done relays enough that we should really expect the relay to be successful? Have we done rundowns enough that we should expect not to screw up a rundown? Have we done first and third plays enough to expect to be able to do them? And to me, I think that's another area that we have to start to be a little bit more aware as coaches and as parents, because let's just be honest, if we haven't worked on some of those more advanced skills, more advanced techniques a lot, the idea of thinking we're going to be really good at them is fool's gold.
Far-fetched. No, and you've talked about this on the podcast a number of times too, Tori, about just talking about things and doing and getting the reps with those skills or with those concepts. And, you know, if we're thinking back saying, yeah, but we talked about this just before the game, or we talked about this before this tournament, the fact of it is, if we haven't done the reps, not just talked about it, it doesn't warrant a yelling opportunity, does
right.
it?
Yeah. Well, no, but I think that's one of the things for us, especially as coaches, that we have to think through. So let's say we're playing in a game and our team screws up a rundown and we've actually not practiced it at all,
physically,
or very, very little practiced it at all. And then, you know, we come up with the, well, we know it's, you know, push her back one throw, tag her out. Well, okay, we could have all the catchphrases in the world, but the catchphrase is obviously
sounds
not
cool.
Gonna, right. It's not going to solve the problem. if we haven't practiced it enough.
But it makes you as a coach look like you know what you're talking about. Right.
And so and we're gonna come back to that.
Even though our kids didn't do it.
Keep that thought down for a second. Okay.
Yeah.
As we're thinking about that. And so then, you know, have we worked on those things enough? Are the things that we're practicing on a regular basis really solving these problems, or are we just doing the same things over and over again at practice and not adjusting as we need to? So again, you know, rundowns is a perfect example. If all we do to practice rundowns is a couple of dart throws, but we don't put kids on base and actually execute rundowns over and over and over again, for whatever reason, we just don't like it. We don't want to. You know, the kids get mad if they have to run too much. You know, I'm afraid somebody might sprain an ankle or something running in these drills at practice. You know, whatever the excuse is, the reason is that we're not doing it.
The infield's too rough.
Yeah. Whatever those explanations are for why we're not doing it, then we have to also be realistic about, well, is it okay for me to yell at a kid who can't do these things because my practice doesn't set them up to get better at it?
Sure.
Right? So there's a lot of things that we want to be thinking about. So are we doing the things that we need to? And so I think you touched on the point that I really wanted us to get to with this is, are we yelling because we think it's going to solve the problem? Are we yelling because we think we're going to get the kids amped up and fired up and that's going to make them play better? Or are we yelling so that everybody knows that it's not my fault that we just screwed that up?
Because I know what we're supposed to be doing.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I think is a key thing I wanted us to get into a little bit, because I think a lot of my yelling was because I was so insecure as a coach when I was a younger coach that I couldn't bear the thought of somebody thinking it was really my fault that we were bad at something.
Yeah, well, maybe so, huh?
You know, it's like, the if I had a dollar for every time as a young coach I yelled, "We just worked on that."
Right.
How can you screw that up? We just worked on that. We work on that every single day. How can you screw that up? It wasn't because I thought that was going to solve the problem. It was because I said it loud enough that everybody who wanted to hear it could hear, hey, it's not my fault.
It wasn't me.
Yeah, it's not my fault. And now, coaches, I'm going to cut you a little bit of slack, because sometimes it really isn't your fault, because sometimes you really do work on it a lot.
And we did cover it, sure.
And sometimes you really have invested enough time in it, and we still mess it up. But if we've done all the things that we're supposed to do as a coach, then what are we really gaining by yelling at our kids for screwing up anyhow? Because again, come back to the moral to the story, they're not screwing up on purpose. I mean, nobody makes a mistake because that, you know.
That was the goal of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen a softball player yet who I think is going to the ballpark with an agenda of, I bet you I could cost us a game today.
If I drop that last ball.
I'm so mad at this team. I'm so mad at my coach. I want to get even. I'm going to make sure we lose today. I just don't think that is happening.
The old bad news Bears thing?
Yeah, well, that might be the extreme example. But so, coaches, that's the thing we want to talk about. And again, this is definitely, don't throw stones when you live in a glass house kind of thing, because I was a screamer and a yeller. I still will catch myself periodically getting angry about something at the ballpark. Now, I think I'm much better than I used to be, but I think it's something that I still need to be more aware of. And I think for all of our coaches and parents too, because parents are in this same boat, the parents who yell at their kid for making a mistake because they want to make sure that, we don't blame you as a parent for being a bad parent somehow too, right? If your kid dropped a fly ball, must mean that you're a bad parent. Or if your kid struck out with the bases loaded and a chance to win the game, must mean that you're a bad parent. So all this yelling is,
if we remove that yelling, it wouldn't change things.
Right. And the outcome's not going to be, the result of that exact play, the thing that we want to yell at isn't going to change anyhow, because yelling at it doesn't undo it. Yelling at it doesn't.
Or make the next one better.
Right. Yeah. It's much more likely to make the next one worse, right?
Right.
So the whole yelling thing, the whole idea of yelling a lot, is something that I think we want to address, and we want to, do some real soul searching. Now, again, as we said earlier, if you want to use it as an arousal technique once in a while, you want to get your kids fired up once in a while, I mean, that's for each coach to decide. Now, I don't think this is a game that we play great, like, foaming at the mouth, crazy running around like lunatics kind of thing, because I think there's too much fine motor skill and too much focus and concentration that has to happen. But a little bit of pump me up,
to wake them up, depending on the setting,
get my attention is okay once in a while.
Yeah.
But I think if we want it, and we want it to really be effective, it's got to be strategic, it's got to have a purpose, and it cannot be an all-the-time thing.
Constructive, not destructive, yeah.
Right. Yep. And one of the things we've talked about is that I know some of those players that played for me when I was a younger coach, that there are some that responded to it really well and loved me as a coach because they thought it pushed them to excel. And there are others that hated it.
Different personalities.
And despised it.
Yep.
And so that's always going to be true. But I think we're in a time and age now where it's just so much less acceptable to be a screamer and yeller that if we want it to really be effective, it's got to be a very strategic thing that we're using on a very rare basis. And if we're finding ourselves yelling at every single game, yelling at players all the time, we're missing the boat. And I think it's going to come back to we need to do some real soul searching about what we're doing in practices, what we're doing in training, the drills that we're creating, and the message that we're sending to our players.
I think that's a good topic, Tori. We're going to change the game a little bit maybe today.
Right.
That's nice.
Well, and the other thing is, where else in the world anymore is it okay for the boss to yell at the employees?
Ooh.
You know what I mean?
It just doesn't happen anymore. Yeah.
The occasional situation where that's still acceptable, you know, maybe you work for your dad and your dad's just not going to change kind of thing.
Right.
But even your dad probably can have to get called to the HR department at some businesses if it's being handled badly. So coaches, just think it through. Make sure
Mom's going to get you when we get home.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. When I tell Mom what you said right. to me at work today, yeah, but so I think it's just important that we keep growing and rolling with the punches and understanding what might have worked once upon a time might not keep working. So that's going to take us down to our cleanup topic. All right, Don, so too many travel teams. What do you think?
There's no question, Tori, that there's many, many options, and there's many orgs. There's more kids playing. So that kind of helps inspire a lot of the roster opportunities. But I think today we're going to talk about how that's created a little bit of a void for key components, right?
Right. So good news. A lot more kids are playing fast pitch softball than did once upon a time. The fact that there's so many more kids necessitates that we need more teams. The first thing I wanted just to touch on is, yes, we need more teams to allow more kids to play, but do we need more teams all aspiring to say that they are high-level, highly competitive, really strong teams to allow all those kids to play? My point is, and Don, we're going to get into this, is there's not enough high-level pitching to staff the teams that are all claiming to be high-level teams.
Right.
If you go on any of the Facebook groups that we post in, and you scroll for more than like 3 seconds, you're going to come up with at least 8 different teams from 8 different age groups, all have the basic same post, looking for one more pitcher to round out our amazing team, looking for 2 pitchers to fill out our great roster. We've got great hitters, we've got great defense, but we just need pitching. Not enough mound time on the team that you're on. Come join us because we really need you. And if we're going to have all these teams at some point in time, we got to have enough pitchers and enough kids that really want to pitch to staff them. And the reality of it is that even when there were less teams, there would never seem to be enough really good pitchers to go around.
Right.
Well, once upon a time, there were 6 or 8 teams, in, let's say an 18 and under, 6 or 8 teams in the Atlanta area, which is a gigantic city with thousands and thousands of softball players. We had 6 or 8 teams that said they were high-level, super competitive teams.
And they really were. Yeah.
And that was probably it.
Yeah.
Well, now, in that same quote-unquote age group, with that same demographic, that same market, we've got 75 teams that all say that they're aspiring to be...
8 organizations.
Yeah, they're all aspiring to be the best 18 and under team in Atlanta, the best 18 and under team in Georgia. Well, if we've got 75 teams all trying to get pitchers, obviously we're going to have problems. The reality of it is more players playing is great. Having more teams is a necessity, but I think the first thing we need to talk about is I think the people that are putting the teams together need to be realistic or honest with themselves about how high up the food chain do we really have to be aiming to match up with what the vast majority of our players really need.
The capabilities.
Right. Yeah. Now, I think what the problem is that a lot of these teams are not born out of just the altruistic idea of having a place for the kids to play, but they're born of the, so my daughter's not good enough to be the shortstop on this team, so I'm going to put together a team, and she's going to be the shortstop, and we're going to be better than you. Ha ha, we'll show you.
Mm-hmm.
Which then means that same dad slash coach now has to go out and get some pretty good pitching, because he's got to prove to that other coach that they were A, wrong about my daughter being good enough to be the starting shortstop, and B, that, you know, I'm going to, you know, put together a team with my daughter as the starting shortstop that's better than your team.
And those kids don't just materialize. They're coming from other groups, thinning out other teams, right?
Right. And so we end up, you know, with this cascading effect of teams that are supposedly at the top of the pyramid pilfering players from teams that are the next level down, and those teams have to pilfer players from the next level down. And before you know it, the whole thing just keeps getting more and more watered down. But so the talent is pool is big, but it's not big enough to supply an unlimited number of teams. The other thing, too, that I think that is part of the problem is we've got more and more now organizational stuff going on where
so many more coming.
Right. And where coaches think that they're going to get more players by being part of these big name organizations. And then that adds another level of pressure to the coaches and the teams, because if we're going to say we're part of big time travel organization A, that we've got to have a certain level of player and a certain level of success, or otherwise we're not going to be able to be part of that group or be part of that organization. And in a lot of cases, we're spending a lot of money to be part of these organizations, and they're going to hold us to a standard, which again, I think adds more problems. The other thing I want us to think about is when we think about most teams, most of them have a core group, a couple of kids that are probably really highly talented, highly skilled players. And again, some of that's because of if I don't get to be the shortstop on one team, I'm going to go be the shortstop on another team. But then that forces a lot of these teams that are aspiring to play at a pretty high level to keep going further and further down the ranks to try to find the players to round out the team. And I think that that's part of what's leading to this dilemma. And then, you know, looking for more and more opportunities for kids to pitch, to try to fill the void so they have enough pitching to be competitive.
So I was going to say that's kind of a good thing, because there's a lot of opportunity for kids to become pitchers maybe, right? For, in particular, the young ones.
Right.
They can, again, aspire and grow into, a lot of, I guess, real spots to play. And that's where they get better, competing and playing. But
right.
In the meantime, we are definitely, thin in the pitching
right.
realm.
Well, and now here's what I think would go a long way, is if we could understand that the dynamic of how a team can be put together should change, and that more players who are really aspiring to play at the highest level need to accept that there's some challenges that go along with playing at the highest level. Why do most kids want to play on the highest level travel ball team they can? Because they want to go to the highest level college program that they can.
Sure.
They play on a high level travel team because they want to get recruited. They play high level travel ball or travel ball in general because they think it's going to open the doors for them to play in college. Well, all of us need to accept then that the end that we're chasing after, the goal that we're shooting for, requires us to learn how to compete. And if more people, parents, players, coaches, could understand that competition is on the horizon, it's going to be there for these kids when they go to college, let's start allowing that to happen mm-hmm. more as we progress through the system. And now we've talked about this, dozens of times. That unfortunately what has happened is, for most parents, they look at what they're spending on travel ball, and the only way that it feels like a good investment is if their kid gets to play all the time. And what I think we have to start to understand, especially for kids that are aspiring to play in college and kids that want to play high-level college softball, is that the investment shouldn't be in how much do I get to play, but how much do I really get to prepare and be prepared for that challenge of reaching that goal. And, one of the things that I've seen, dozens and dozens of times, that there are certain parts of the country where competition is built into the travel ball world more than others. So that there are some, places where kids are in travel ball organizations knowing that they're paying all this money and it doesn't guarantee them anything except a uniform and a chance to play. It doesn't guarantee them a starting position. It doesn't guarantee them playing time. It doesn't guarantee them anything. And if we could kind of take a little bit of that magic pixie dust and spread it over more teams, more people, I think we could solve some of this problem. Because then what would end up happening is, and we'll just use the Atlanta area for an example, we would end up with 10 or 12 really good teams who really are aspiring to play at the very highest level, who are really playing to be the very best 18 and under team in the area and in the state and ultimately in the nation. And then we could have another group of teams that know they're not quite there, and that's okay, because we're still playing, we're still getting a lot of, you know, enjoyment out of it. We're still, you know, for some of those kids aspiring to play, but maybe not quite at the same level of college program, and there's nothing wrong with that. And then we start to, I guess, stratify the situation a little bit, start to put people in groups
like tiers.
That kind of makes sense. Like, yeah, tiers is a perfect way to say it, Don, because if we had 12 teams aspiring to be great, we've got 24 great pitchers in Atlanta.
Well, and just like you're saying right there, is if we describe what one of those championship teams or somebody that shows really well at nationals, if we describe those teams and we want 10 of them, they've got to have two number ones,
right,
pitching for them, or maybe more.
Right, two or three.
Two to three.
But so that's my point. So if we're
taking those three, and
right. If let's say in the Atlanta area right now, and this is just a number, I'm sure it's different, but let's say we have 24 great pitchers in 18 and under.
Yep.
24 pitchers that could, you know, can compete nationally in 18 and under. If we had 12 teams with two of those pitchers on each one,
Rockstar, or
eight teams with three of those pitchers on each one, we would have eight great teams that really could play for a national championship.
Right.
And they would be outstanding, kind of like not that long ago when we were talking about when I first started recruiting here, when we had, you know, you only had to watch six teams because those six teams had already sorted out who all the best players were.
Yeah.
But what we've got instead of 12 teams with two great pitchers each, we've got 36 teams that are all saying they're in that same category, and we don't even have one pitcher for each team then. And that's to me, the problem. So if we would kind of swallow our pride a little bit, and instead of thinking, well, if I'm going to spend $10,000 this year on softball, my daughter better play 92% of the inning. We say, well, I'm going to spend $10,000 on softball this year because my daughter's going to compete. She's going to learn to fight. She's going to be on a really good team. She's going to have an opportunity to get seen by all the great coaches, but she's going to have to work her butt off to get into the lineup. And because of that, it's going to make her a better player. I just think this, a lot of these problems could disappear. Unfortunately, the realist in me knows that we're going the other direction.
Well, the $10,000, you want to be on a team that has a chance to make it to the end.
Right.
Yeah, I would think.
Yeah. And I know, you know, and again, that's just an arbitrary number. For some people, it's way more than that.
Sure.
For some people, it's way less than that. But for everybody, it's the same thing. If I'm spending $100 a month for my kid to be on the team, and that $100 is a really big deal to me, I expect a really big payoff.
She's only getting part-time.
Right. Yeah. I expect a payoff. And so I think that's one of the things that we need to adjust. So, you know, trying to see the picture differently, that it's not about how much time do I get on the field as much as what are the things that I'm gaining from really being on this team. If we could start with that adjustment, I think we'd be going a long way.
And Tori, other than listening to the podcast, which all coaches should tell their parents to listen to it, right? Is that the coach's job to sell that concept or that idea on a particular group, I guess?
Well, I think it starts with coaches selling that agenda.
You can let them listen to this for sure.
Right. But I think it's also parents just coming to grips with the fact that what we're doing right now is not working very well.
It's not maybe the best path.
Right. Yeah. And the reality of it is I see more kids now than ever. Now, obviously, there's a lot more kids playing, but I see a lot more kids wanting to quit. I see a lot more kids that are unhappy. I see a lot more teams that are just not very good, who have two or three really good players who are really unhappy because they're two or three really good players on a pretty average or bad team because, for whatever reason, you know, they have to be the starting shortstop. So, you know, the only way I can be the starting shortstop is to be on this team. Whereas if I was willing to compete to maybe be the shortstop, but maybe play right field or maybe be a part-time player and a utility player on a great team, I have to be on the team that promises me I'm going to be the shortstop. And it's just this never-ending cycle of, because I've got to get my money's worth, I'm not really getting my money's worth.
I find myself too as a parent, Tori, guarding my kids from pain, the pains of life. You know, there's going to be challenges and pains in life when you don't get the things you want.
Right.
And often I feel like I'm setting them up for disappointment later by not letting them experience more of that now. And I battle that inside too. So I get it.
Oh no, but I understand it 100%. And I understand the business aspect of it. I mean, you know, if I'm paying the same amount of money that you're paying for the exact same service, I expect to get the exact same service. But we've turned softball into a service business, and it's not really
rather than a competitive business.
Right. It's not supposed to be everybody pays the same fee, everybody gets the same thing. At least not if we want to solve this problem. Why is it a problem? Because watching softball with teams that have no pitching is a nightmare. And right now we have whole tournaments going on where teams are, one pitcher who's pitching way too much because she's the only pitcher we have.
Right.
And
she
getting burned out and getting
used
up.
She doesn't get
up.
To show as well as she
right.
could.
Right. So she's held together with duct tape and
80%
and zip ties. And then we've got other teams that are out there competing that have, they have kids who want to be pitchers.
Or
honestly have been told they can be the starting pitcher on this team because we're so desperate for a pitcher that we're going to take anybody who says that their arm will make a circle and can throw it towards home plate, even though she can't throw strikes. If she does throw a strike, we don't have to worry about the catcher ever catching it because the ball's going to get hit into orbit someplace. And to me, it's a situation that if we want to start to head in a better direction, I think we need to start to adjust the way we're thinking about this stuff. And so,
or we may not enjoy it quite as much as we know we could.
And Stan raises a good point, Don. The flip side of this, I have to get my money's worth part of it, is that the rosters keep getting smaller and smaller.
They run thin.
Right. So you used to have a roster of 18 kids so that if somebody was sick or somebody wasn't there, it was no big deal. You still had other quality kids.
Weren't playing well that day for whatever reason.
You know, now there is no competition because we have 12 kids on the team. Three of them are pitchers, so they're going to rotate through the roster, even though they're not really pitchers or they're not good pitchers. They're just kids that can throw the ball towards home plate. And then some kid can show up and she knows she's going to be the shortstop because, my dad started the team so I could be the shortstop, or he promised my dad I'd be the shortstop. Whether they work hard, whether they play well, whether they do any of the stuff that we expect them to do.
Well, when I hear too, I'm kind of shocked, Tori, when I hear, and it seems more at the younger age group, but I'm really quite shocked when I hear the number of kids that are on a roster when they're saying, we've got 11 and we're kind of open to maybe one more. And my mouth opens and I'm like, how can you run a season on 11 kids? Even 12 is, I think, very thin. You're so vulnerable and having to introduce pickup players all season long. And, those people aren't going through the same sacrifices that your group is. And they just hop in there and they get plugged in for a weekend. It kind of seems odd and awkward to me. But from a coaching standpoint, they're just trying to, accommodate the desire or the expectation of the parent for playing time. And I think that bites us a little bit in the butt in the end because, we are wore out at the end of a tournament if we are a good team.
Right.
We are wore out at the end of a tournament and we end up losing because we're tired and because we're too thin in numbers. And, I know we've talked about it a number of times in previous podcasts about some of the national championship teams that, we coached in college or the travel ball kids that you've worked with and you've gone off to nationals and, had to battle against teams that maybe had 18 kids in the dugout. And, just through injury and things like that, we ended up a little bit thinner than we would have liked to have been. And those groups end up, sneaking past us.
Right. Well, and that's a perfect example. When we were out in Colorado a couple of years ago, we ended up losing in the semifinals to a team from Arizona that had, I want to say, 20 kids on their roster, maybe even more than that.
Right.
But what they were able to do, because we both played, I think we played 11 or 12 games over like a, 4-day period, 3-day period. So it was a lot of softball because we kept winning.
Yeah.
And so every time they were ahead by 3 or 4 runs, they could give a kid a couple innings off. They could, go to their third or fourth or fifth pitcher because they had a big enough lead that they could afford to rest their number one pitcher. They could, You know, let the kids have a break. They could pinch run for everybody at least once every game. And at the end of the tournament, when we were dragging, because even if we were beating somebody 6-0, 8-0, 10-0, one of our best pitchers had to keep pitching because that was who we had to pitch.
That was what was going to keep you
right.
in the, yeah.
Hey, yeah, I mean, no, and we didn't have anybody else to put in. You know, it wasn't like we had a third string pitcher that was able to mop up the innings in a game that we were killing somebody because we didn't have that person on the roster.
Right.
So one of the two kids who we really needed to pitch well had to pitch the last two innings of a game we were winning 8-0 because we didn't have any options. Well, those extra innings add up, and all of a sudden we're in that semifinal game, and their pitcher, it looks like she hasn't even barely broken a sweat all weekend, and our kid is out there and looks like her right arm is 4 inches longer than her left arm because she's thrown so much.
Well, and you know, if the end game is being recruited and so forth, that's when you want to look fresh.
Right.
That's where the coaches are going to be. They're coming to watch the kids that make it to the end.
Right. And the last thing, and we'll wrap this up on this one. So, you know, so the competition that we want the kids to learn, the attitude that we want to adjust, the way we want to start to think differently about how we're investing our money in travel ball. If the goal is for your daughter to be a college softball player, there is not a single college softball program in the country that has 12 kids on it unless they've had some sort of crazy, crazy thing happen. Everybody's got 16, 18, 20, 22, some of the bigger schools, 30 kids on the roster fighting for this spot, fighting for a playing spot, fighting for a starting position. And that's the thing that we're really cheating our kids. And we're going to talk here about another thing that kind of goes along with this, about how there's opportunities that we could really be helping our kids be successful when they get to college that we're missing out on. And the number of kids who, you know, aspire to play college softball that are unprepared for it because they don't know how to compete because they've always been promised a spot is a problem. And so this whole too many teams in the travel ball world is a problem. It's going to continue to get worse. It's not going to get better unless we change our approach to it, the way we change our attitude about it. And I'm hoping that this kind of discussion will start to get at least a few people thinking about what's really better for the end game. And the end game is I want my daughter to play at Big School X. Well, if I want her to play at Big School X, is it going to happen because I negotiate her a starting position or she earns a starting position? Is it going to be better served because she knows how to work for what she wants or because somebody's going to guarantee her what she wants? And I know if she wants to be the starting shortstop at real competitive softball college program, it's not going to be because somebody is so happy to have her or promised her a starting position. It's going to be because she earned it there. So let's put them in a position where we have a few less teams, a little bit more competition, a few less promises, a little bit more competition, and let's see where that takes us. And I think for the overall health of the game and for the enjoyment factor of everybody playing it, life's going to be a whole lot better.
No, I think it's a good topic. We can come back to it another day too, Tori. And, you know, the five balls you get in a game are important, and that's a good, intense time to be working on your skills. But the hundreds that you take in practice are going to be ones that enhance your skills to the point where you'll be the one getting those five in the game.
Yeah,
so.
And if you're at a practice with other really good players working really hard, trying to get ahead and trying to prove that they deserve to play,
it rubs off.
Yeah, you're going to get a whole lot better, a whole lot faster. So, Don, that's going to take us to our coaching tip of the week. This coaching tip of the week is one I was just thinking about today because there's a girl that I work with quoted the great Deion Sanders. The quote goes something like, if you look good, you feel good. If you feel good, you play good.
I like Deion, and when he said his name, I was like, that's going to be all right.
If you look good, you feel good. If you feel good, you play good. So what's the connection between looking good and playing good?
Well, I think there's a little bit to it for sure. I always appreciate when you look out at a ball game and people look sharp. Their uniforms are clean, and they look like they're uniform.
Yeah.
You know, everybody looks the same. We look sharp. Again, I think it's the beginning of something good, right?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's important is that we can look good and not necessarily have to have the world's greatest budget. We don't have to necessarily be spending thousands and thousands of dollars on swag. We don't have to have some sort of unlimited, endless pool of supplies. We're thinking about a practice uniform that all the kids could wear black pants and we could give them all a practice t-shirt. Is the most simple, fundamental thing. If you've got 20 kids on your roster, You're going to spend $150 on t-shirts or $200 on t-shirts max.
Right.
They're all probably have a pair of black pants from some team that they've played on in the past, or you can let them wear last year's uniform pants as this year's practice pants. And just like that, we have a uniform look where when they show up at practice, we always know we're part of this team.
Look sharp. Yeah.
To me, I think it's important for uniforms that uniforms look uniform. You know, when we go to the ballpark and we're going to play, that we look sharp, that we're dressed properly, that, you know, that the uniforms worn the correct way. You know, obviously at the college level, you know, we were always sticklers about the sleeves would be down because we were there to play softball, not worry about tan lines. You know, that the...
What do you think about cleats? They should be uniform as well.
The jerseys would be tucked in at the college level. You know, we were lucky enough that we had shoes that, you know that all the kids matched. But again, it doesn't necessarily have to be that they all have Nike, but they all could have black.
Yes.
You know, and those kinds of things. But I think practice gear is another thing. And again, it doesn't have to be a super gigantic investment. T-shirts are not that expensive. You know, dry fit t-shirts are not that expensive.
But when we're the same, it looks official. It feels official, like a real thing.
And it's building that cohesiveness that we're talking about. You know, if you're in a situation like a college team or a pretty strong travel team, if you're traveling together, you know, I always liked the idea of travel gear, one, because it made it easy to identify us. And that was something that was important to me. If I was in the airport with
keeping track of
with 20-some college players, you know, I didn't want to, you know, have to remember that, you know, Don had a tie-dyed t-shirt on and Stan had a purple t-shirt on, and trying to, you know, keep track of everybody. I wanted everybody wearing our school colors so that it was easier to identify, and kind of gave everybody that feeling of unity when we were traveling. But things like bat bags, helmets, those kinds of things, I think over time, the teams that are in a position where they can invest in that kind of stuff, that there is a benefit to it. I think that if we're looking uniform, it makes us feel more uniform. If we all look like we're part of the same team, we start thinking like, we're really all part of the same team.
Like you said, when you see a group like that, it's like they got it together. They're doing something on purpose. And when you see a group like that at the ballpark, you're like, hey, I'm going to check them out and see if they play as well as they, you know, prepare and look. Yeah.
Well, and one example I couldn't help but thinking about, you know, we talked about our good friends, the Oregon Ducks, a bunch in the past.
Yeah.
And supporting Coach Lombardi and her program. And that one of the things that helped Oregon athletics kind of get on the map was, you know, and obviously their affiliation with Nike puts them in a pretty good position. And we talk about the unlimited budget thing that we were talking about before. I think they might have an unlimited budget when it comes to,
they're going
to
look good
to things like that. But, you know, they were pushing the envelope a little bit, coming up with some, you know, some stylish stuff, some flashy stuff, some things that maybe were a little bit outside the box that gave them an identity. And again, now that's one extreme end of the spectrum, but, you know, to me, I think there's, you know, a lot to be said for that. You know, once upon a time, when I was coaching at UW Parkside, and when I was coaching at UW Parkside, we were as poor a softball team as you possibly could have. Our budget was so tiny. I probably spent 25 times more of my time on fundraising.
You had to get creative.
And that kind of thing than I did on coaching. I mean, it was every chance we had to figure out a way to make a few bucks. You know, we were doing the camps, the clinics, the academies. You know, I was speaking. You know, we were doing all kinds of things, you know, out in the community, just everything we could to try to raise money. And so one year we were lucky enough, we had a sponsorship with Easton to provide us with bats. And they gave us some just plain white Easton t-shirts that just had the little Easton logo like over the heart. They were, you know, just your basic white t-shirts. And so, and that was nice.
Put a number on the back.
Yeah. So, but what we ended up deciding to do is, my wife being the creative person that she was, took a tie-dye class and took, you know, all these Nike white t-shirts, tie-dyed them. They looked awesome.
Right.
But they still looked uniform because, you know, the same person did them all. Yep. So the pattern wasn't exactly the same on everyone, but you could clearly tell that everyone was from that team. So you had the little, you know, Easton logo over the heart. You had this really cool school color tie-dye thing because it was school colors. It wasn't like rainbow or something crazy.
Right,
it was, you know, something that matched the school colors. And then we put the player's name and numbers heat pressed on the back.
Nice, yeah.
And all of a sudden, we had a really cool-looking little shirt that didn't cost us hardly anything. And fortunately, we were lucky enough that somebody gave us the t-shirts. But if you buy a plain t-shirt, it's not that expensive anyhow.
Right.
And so we were able to do something like that and have a really unique
and special
and outstanding thing that and so it ended up being something that the kids then wanted to wear when we traveled. What we started off thinking was going to be their practice shirt kind of became their claim to fame. And so we would always be looking for things like that we could do, because we couldn't afford to go just, go wild buying things.
Sure, get it all.
I was aggressive enough, and we were lucky enough to be successful enough that, we were able to kind of negotiate some things along the way and get a free set of t-shirts or a free set of hats or a free set of something from different people. And all that stuff helped to add to that feeling of unity. And so, building that team and having your team play well is something that we're all trying really hard to do. And I do think there is a connection between the whole, if you feel good, if you look good, you're probably going to play better. And I think it's worth investing in. And again, you don't have to break the bank, but I think you can do a lot of creative stuff that's going to really give you some of that unity that we're talking about.
No, and Tori, I like that whole thought. And there's nothing wrong with having an expectation on people looking sharp and not being wild and crazy, shirts out, shirts in.
Right.
Sleeves up, sleeves down to look the same.
Tucking your shirts in and wearing the sleeves down the way they're supposed to be worn is not
doesn't
an expectation that costs you
effort.
A penny.
Yeah, it's not a special effort.
It doesn't cost you a nickel. Yeah. And even if that's the only thing that we do, I think we're already on the right track. Because I know somebody's like, well, what difference does it make if she rolls her shirt sleeves up or not? If they're that worried about their tan lines, go to the beach. That's all I'm going to say.
Little things, right?
Because it's just one more thing that says, I'm more worried about me than I'm worried about this team.
Right.
Period. And nobody's going to tell me any different. That'll be my soapbox moment of the day.
We'll get it.